Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Heritage Radio Network On Tour. I'm Sam Ben Ruby from The Grape Nation. Today we're broadcasting live from Charleston Wine and Food. We want to thank the Julia Child Foundation for making our coverage possible and to Charleston Wine and Food Festival for having HRN down here for the fifth year in a row. Our guest today is Ryan Zapaltis. Ryan is the winemaker and GM or... Winemaker and GM for Copain Winery in Sonoma in California. Welcome to the Grape Nation, Ryan.
Sam, thanks for having me here.
Is this your first festival?
It is. I've been to Charleston many, many times, but never this
Okay,
festival.
So we'll talk about that in a minute. I think, as I tell a lot of my listeners about my guests, I think they probably know your wines more than they know you, but you're the guy that makes the wines. So give me a little background on your journey in life and wine that got you to where you are today, which is making the wines and pretty much running Copain.
Yeah, so I grew up in the state of Wisconsin.
Where?
Eau Claire, Wisconsin.
Because I went to Madison.
Okay.
Where'd you go to college?
Eau Claire.
Okay.
Sometimes.
All right. A lot of beer.
Yeah, a lot of trouble. So I grew up in the state of Wisconsin, had really no, wine was not really part of my life at all. As you mentioned, cheap beer.
There's like 7 bottles of wine in the whole state.
Yeah, well, it's changed quite a bit.
Okay.
Yeah, Madison, Milwaukee
are
incredible
food wine towns. Don't let me keep interrupting, all right? Go ahead.
That's okay. I finished school in 98. I was looking kind of what to do next. And my cool aunt... that lived in California in the Russian River Valley. She was a sales rep for a small distributor. And she was just like, when you finish school, just come out to California and screw off for summer. You can stay with us, figure out your life. You know, I just finished school. And
so just set something up in my mind. Is this your mom or your dad's sister?
This is my dad's sister.
It's a real blood aunt and all that.
Yep. She's a cool lady that moved from Wisconsin to California.
And when she said that, were your parents supportive? Like, okay, give it a shot or...
Yeah, they were. Okay. Yeah. I mean, she was like the crazy aunt, so they probably were a little like, not crazy, but like the wild aunt, I'd say. And so maybe they were a
not
little
the
worried.
The typical Eau Claire aunt.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah, so I moved out there for summer. I was really into skateboarding at the time. Like, I kind of had some stuff going in that world, and I wanted to be out in California, so that was my perfect place to go. You know, she had the couch to crash on. And, yes.
What year and how old are we right now? Just to
that was
the 98, chronology of
right when I turned 23. So, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
All right, so you go out and then what happens?
So eventually ran out of my life savings of $400. Decided I wanted to stay in California, and I, you know, I'd met this guy who ran a wine cellar. He ran the cellar at La Crema back in the day. And I met him at a dinner party and he's like, come work harvest for me. You can make a lot of overtime cash and whatever. And I was just like, oh, that sounds cool. I'll be by the wine, you know, like just sounded cool. And so I did my first harvest in 98, just digging tanks, dragging hoses, all like the shit work.
Really a cellar rat.
I didn't mean to cuss on your, show.
No, don't worry about
all right,
that.
All right.
Cellar rat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So an intern.
Are you loving it though?
I was loving it. I love the excitement of harvest. I love, you know, pushing pumps around, climbing tanks, doing all that stuff. I love the excitement. And so I kind of decided, like, yeah, I think I'll kind of try to stay here and see what happens.
So that was a defining moment. Like, this is something I can and want to do.
Yeah. At the time, I just thought it was a cool job. And then a couple of years doing that, I got tipped off that you could go work in other countries and do harvest there. And one of the winemakers at the time, he said, you should go to New Zealand and work. It's really fun. And you can meet some girls and travel and blah, blah, blah. And I was just like, okay, cool, whatever. And so when I went to New Zealand, I worked for Villa Maria. I worked for Michelle Richardson. She's a legendary winemaker down there. And, you know, she gave me a lot of responsibility. I think my resume made it seem like I knew way more.
Knew more than anyone knew you should have gotten, right?
So she's like, oh, you made Pinot? Well, you're in charge of Pinot and Chardonnay. I'm like, okay, what do you mean by in charge? So she gave me a lot of responsibility, and I had to do my own lab work, kind of in charge of the Pinot cellar.
Did you take it seriously? I mean, you were diligent and head down and all
that.
Yeah, you didn't want to disappoint her.
Right, and I really felt like I rose to the occasion, and that was kind of the turning point. When I came back to the States, I was like, all right, I want to be a winemaker someday. So,
how long were you there?
6 months. Okay. I worked for like 4, I think. And
why do you return? Because you finished the 4 months, you tooled around a little.
Couldn't find a Kiwi girl to marry me.
Right. So you come back. You go not to Wisconsin, but to California.
Back to California.
All right, so take it from there.
So worked for a temp agency and bopped around doing wine cellar work at various wineries that summer. And eventually my resume landed on Adam Lee of Siduri Wine's desk. And he was just looking to build a cellar team. At the time, Siduri was
tiny. That early Siduri days, or he had established it? He was on his way up.
So they had just, they started in 94, and this was summer of 2000. And they had just kind of started to get a lot more press. You know, Parker broke them mid-90s, and they were just kind of building on that. So they were like sourcing single vineyard, you know, grapes from Santa Rita, Oregon, San Lucia Highlands, Russian River, Sonoma Coast. And so they were just like growing. And so they were really tiny winery. I started working for him 3 weeks into harvest. He offered me a full-time job because he's like, I don't know how we did this without you. And so,
wow.
It was pretty cool.
What was the job he offered?
Just full-time. I was like a temp.
Not a title, but you have a job full-time.
Maybe cellar master.
Okay,
or
so
like
that. Where does that go?
So I worked for Adam for many years, kind of worked my way up there, eventually became his assistant winemaker. And then in parallel to that, he gave me the opportunity to make my own wines there. And so I started Zapaltis Wines while working for Siduri.
What year?
That was 2004.
Okay.
And so, yeah, I ran Zapaltis Wine at the same time as doing Siduri.
How much wine were you making?
Zapaltis at its peak was about 3,500 cases, but we started small with like 100.
Wow.
And then, so I did both those simultaneously for many years, started doing some consulting work, had a bunch of small projects. And then, yeah, the Copan opportunity kind of rose to the surface, 2016. Yeah, and I officially came over there.
You think Copan, you think Wells Guthrie.
Right.
Right. Right. So obviously during 16, Wells comes to you, or you come to him?
Well, his bosses came to me.
Okay.
And they had joined Jackson family prior that year, and I'd been through a Siduri acquisition, and I think I just like really played well with the main office and kind of just helped kind of bring some structure to the place, just so Wells could just focus on the wine. So I actually came over as a general manager. So we had some overlap. He eventually moved on to new things, and I took over the winemaking.
Was the overlap awkward, or was he helping you, or was?
No, it was pretty good actually.
It was no big deal.
Yeah, it was
okay.
Yeah, I always got along with Wells just fine. So yeah, I was a huge fan of his wines all those years, and I really liked when he went for a more restrained style. And
right, your sensibilities.
And I think a lot of people sort of copied him. And yeah, so for me to kind of take over the helm and kind of carry on that legacy and add my little tweaks and keep the style the same, and you know,
so it's only been a little less than 4 years.
Yeah,
right.
I have my hands on like 3 vintages now.
So, okay.
Yeah.
And because you had an admiration for their type of wines, you just went in and put your touch, whatever you could do to make it better, or, you know, carry on the legacy, right?
Yeah, just really stood back and observed the first vintage, and just kind of like understand the sensibilities. And then, you know, year number 2 is like a lot of it had to do with just like elevating the farming, really spending more time with the vineyard guys, and you know, we're in a big push to kind of like really take our farming to the next level. I'm not saying we're going to be fully organic, but we're like definitely.
Well, we'll get into that in a second. But I wanted to ask you something. You basically focus on two grapes. I mean, you may do more, but you are a Pinot and a Chardonnay guy.
Absolutely, yeah.
Right? When you were at Sidori, you know, big Pinot, I think they did a little short. Why did it come to that? I mean, is that something that you pushed in that direction, or that's where you wound up?
Yeah, you know, I think it just has to do with location. You know, being in Russian River Valley, living in Sebastopol at the time, I gradually worked, or naturally ended up working for a Burgundy house, so to speak.
Right.
And I fell in love with Pinot. Napa's like almost a foreign, you know, language to me in a way. Like, I've made Cabernet,
sure.
But
I mean, I just know, you're one guy that could say that with credibility. Do you ever, I asked, I had Nicole Marchese from Farniente, and she makes Cab and Chard. Do you ever itch to make a wine from another grape? I mean, do you ever?
Oh yeah, I got dreams of doing a little bit of everything.
What's at the top of the list?
Well, I'd love us to take a stab at some sparkling wine.
Sparkling
champagne style
Pinot, or introduce new grapes.
Probably Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, kind of go with the classic style.
Do you see that becoming a reality in 2, 3, 5, say?
Maybe.
Are you pushing?
Yeah. I guess the biggest thing I have up my sleeve is I really want to make Cab Franc. I have some experimental lots in the cellar that...
You do?
That don't tell anyone, but they exist.
I
haven't got the green light to bottle.
You just told everyone, but that's okay. Right. Nobody listens to my show anyway. Well, my wife does, and she could keep a secret.
I would love to make Cab Franc. You know, we're making
that. So that's the answer. I mean,
yeah,
Grenache. Sparkling wine and Cab Franc.
Yeah, I think Grenache is.
And I have a feeling that at some point it'll come to that. Is it fair to say that I'm sitting with a guy that likes to make cooler climate wines?
Ah, for sure. For sure.
So tell my listeners what a cooler climate does for the wines that you make, you know, the difference.
So
and it's something that you favor too.
Yeah, for me, why cool climate is important, especially Pinot and Chardonnay, it paces out the growing season.
What does that mean?
It means you get an elongated hang time, but you don't get elevated sugars. These cooler sites tend to have the acidity tends to hang around a little bit better. You know, on the coast, the fog is kind of like the retractable dome in a baseball stadium. It's like, you know, shuts down photosynthesis earlier in the day. So slower paced out ripening gives you more complex fruit, which makes more complex wine, in my opinion. You can't really measure, you can measure sugar, you can measure acid, but you can't really measure flavor, you know, and you can't fake flavor. Well, I suppose you could if you use Mega Purple and stuff like that, but... as far as making pure wines, you know, you can't fake flavor.
So when you're talking about the vineyards and harvesting, because of the cooler climate, and you may have said it, I didn't pick up on it, are you harvesting earlier, middle, or later than normal?
You know, generally on the early plus side, you know, I think...
Because you don't want too much sugar, or...
Exactly. So, okay. I mean, the goal with Copan wines is not to add things or take things away. I don't want to pick something ripe for flavor and then add water back. Like, that's not what we do. We're trying to like have as little inputs to the wine as possible. You know, I want Copan wines to be fermented grape juice.
Well, so let's talk about that. Do you do carbonic maceration? Are you whole cluster? You know, how does that work?
Yes to all. We okay. do whole. We.
Yes to all, always, or depending on the vintage, or...
So, we do whole cluster fermentation a lot on Syrah, a lot on Sonoma Pinot, and very little in Anderson Valley. It just, to me, the color and the pH shift kind of throws the wine off a little, so...
So, can you help me with something? We just talked about something that my listeners may not know about, which is whole cluster fermentation. Like my friend Al Jr. out there, he doesn't know what that is. Tell people what whole cluster fermentation is.
So whole cluster fermentation is instead of when the grapes are picked, they come in on their stems. They're like a bunch of grapes. In most cases, it's processed. It's ran through a destemmer, so you're taking the stalks away.
Which creates a little opening on the grape, right, too, in a way?
Yes.
Right. But by leaving it whole cluster.
So you're fermenting the grapes with that stem, so it can do a number of things to the wine. It can extract a little more like silkier tannin, give it a little backbone. It can really mess with the aromatics. It can make a wine kind of go to more of an exotic level.
You have to control that, but you like that it can add aromatics, right?
Yeah. So it's a fun tool to use. We use it where we think it makes sense. Tends to work better in a cooler year where you have a longer hang time. In warmer, fast vintages, sometimes your stalks are a little green, but, you might adjust the percentage that you would use.
Right. So when you say adjust the percentage, you'll do less whole cluster?
Yes.
So just like to tame down the green or the vegetal or whatever.
Yeah. So in a warm year, I probably would use a lower percentage. So if I was filling a 10-ton tank, I would maybe do 20% stems and the other 80% destemmed on top of
Depending on the vintage. You can control that.
Every vintage, every vineyard, every varietal has something to consider.
So Copain, they're obviously pulling grapes from the vineyards. The vineyards are leased, contracted, managed, owned. Tell me where the grapes come from. You know, how many different sites, where, and, are any yours now?
So as it stands right now, by weight or by grape, it's coming across the scale. We're about 80% estate. Most of our grapes are coming from Anderson Valley, Sonoma Coast, and then some of the outlying areas. We're working a little bit in Monterey in the Chalon District. The Brissot Vineyard, famous vineyard down there. We buy Syrah, Grenache, and Chardonnay from them.
So 80% estate.
Yeah.
Of the 80%, are you making 100% estate wines?
Some of our blends would be considered.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Talk to me about vineyard practices, sustainability, organics, biodynamics. Where are you at with that? How do you feel?
So we're kind of in a bit of a sea change right now. We're really kind of like taking steps to elevate our farming. Right now,
you an influencer on that? Is that?
Yeah, without a doubt.
Like you're the guy pushing that charge?
So as it stands right now, all of our vineyards are, all of our estate properties are at minimum certified sustainable. We buy fruit from a lot of organic growers. We have growers that aren't certified, but they've been practicing that.
Right. You can identify that. Right?
Yeah. So what we're doing with Copain is we're just really elevating, synthetic herbicides are way in the rearview mirror for us. So that's out. What are we doing now in the vineyards? More composting. We're trying to create an ecosystem. We're sort of inventing our own recipe for farming. Our spray program moving forward, plan is to be organic on the spray program.
So in your mind, you have a schedule. At some point, you would like to get somewhere. Maybe you'll get there on time or whatever, but you want to get there, right?
Yeah, there's financial considerations. There's other considerations.
Right.
If you're deep in the fog, it's a little more challenging. A lot more moisture, so there's more pressure from molds, botrytis.
Well, you have, that moisture, the fog. I mean, you're up against some stuff.
But people are doing it and pulling it off, so we're kind of finding our best way. But, I mean, in a nutshell, we're trying to do less conventional things and do more positive things. Trying to think of the vineyards as an ecosystem, not a farm of grapes. Cover crop, mowing versus spraying, like all these things, just less dependence on like conventional practices and more of thinking of it.
Walk me into the cellar now. So now we're in the cellar. You could do a great job outside and you could certainly screw it up in the cellar. Talk to me about cellar practices in that same vein.
Okay, so I think I mentioned it earlier, but I may have mentioned it in the thing I was just in before this, but our goal is to not add things or take things away. So I want,
right, that's
I want
copay, low intervention.
Yeah. So I want to pick my grapes when they're perfectly ripe, so minimize any adjustments in the winery. So they're just fermented grape juice at the end of the day. I mean, obviously, as a winemaker, you might have to adjust some acidity here and there. Our goal is to not ever have to add water. And then in the cellar,
kind of nail it without any addition, right?
Right. I mean, that's the ultimate goal.
Right.
And we don't use commercial yeast, so that we have a really good house yeast and a good malolactic bacteria in house. So fermentations go on their own.
So for me, and it'll help my listeners, is a house yeast an indigenous yeast, or it's a yeast that you have chosen and control?
Indigenous.
It is indigenous.
Yep.
Okay.
And
so that's naturally occurring yeast.
Yeah. Either on the scan, something's in control of the cellar, whether it's something that comes in on the scans, what something that's living in our winery, whatever that ghost is, does a nice job.
Right.
I'm not against commercial cultured yeast.
Right.
Some of the powerful ones can alter mouthfeel, alter aromatics, and we don't want to do that. You know, we want to express the place the grapes are grown. And also in the cellar, we're not using a lot of new wood to obscure things. So our Chardonnays are very, very low percentage of new wood. Pinots might get a little bit more new wood, but
They're wood. I mean, you're not doing any stainless steel.
You know, our rosés will be aged and fermented in stainless, but everything
that makes sense for a rosé.
Yeah, Chards are all barrel fermented. All the reds are barrel aged, tank fermented.
Do you have to deal with any sort of climate change? I mean, are you in the years that you've been, you know, in the wine business in Sonoma? I mean, are you harvesting later, earlier? Are you making adjustments, or you're not there yet?
It's definitely been a slow creep, but the vibes feel totally different than when I first got into it.
Because of that?
Yeah, I think
because of just naturally changing things.
Yeah, I mean, the big thing in the drought years, you know, 2012 through 15, the bud breaks were happening earlier in the vineyard, so the end of the growing season was coming in mid, late August. You know, when I first got in the business, we didn't do anything till after Labor Day. Last year was a little bit different, but what we do in the vineyards, we just try to strategize how we do our canopy management. Do we expose the fruit to sun? Do we have speckled sunlight? Do we pull lots of leaves? Do we pull just a little bit of leaves? All these things based on how the growing season's going.
It's not the same every year, and it's not the same as 5 years ago.
Sometimes you gamble and you win, and sometimes you lose. Sometimes you overexpose the fruit to sun or don't give it enough. So
Napa and Sonoma were pretty well known for some full-throttle wines. You know, through the years, the Parker years and all that stuff. You guys never made wines that way, right?
No. Kind of always
made the wines you wanted to make. You know, Wells and you and all of that. Do you think there's a movement away from that? You know, that restraint is... Are you seeing more of that, or you don't give a crap, or...?
No, I see it, and I think most winemakers would admit that they've kind of dialed back a little bit, even people that were...
Why? Because that's what the consumer wants, or...?
I think probably because they want to drink their own wines more so than the consumer, I think...
So when it comes down to what I like and what's good, this is how it should be done.
Yeah. And
Fair enough?
I just think, you know, as we mature, we like find moderation in most cases. Hopefully we do. And I think, we realize, like, we don't need to pick at monster bricks.
Right.
I even feel like Costa Brown wines are more restrained than they were maybe when they
were pretty big.
For example.
But things have changed over there, too.
So. Right. But the winemaking teams have always been solid. And so, for example, I just think we've all kind of, like, backed off a little bit. Is that the customer demand? Well, I don't know. I kind of feel that way. I feel like our customer appreciates, like, our Chardonnays aren't...
Well, they always did. That's why they came to you. I'm talking about everybody around you, and I think you're right. I mean, you described it correctly.
I mean, Cab is still king.
Do you ever want to make a Cab? When I asked you, sparkling wine and, you know, maybe something else.
Yeah, I would love to make a cool climate Cabernet. I think it was fun. I had some 2010 from a cool vintage yesterday in Napa, from Napa, and it was incredible. It was just cooler vintage cabs, like a little more minty, a little more eucalyptus. I don't know, kind of like
sounds like Heights.
Like Stony Hill.
Heights, yeah. Heights. Yeah.
And sometimes I get kind of intrigued, but all I got right. enough hobbies.
Yeah.
I got trousseau.
You'll get there.
I got pick pool. I
sell
got
the skateboard. Last thing, and then we got to wrap up. Is it fair to say that the Sonoma Coast is sort of having a moment? That's not going to go away, because I think the wines and the people have a very strong conviction. But, I mean, there's some incredible people making wine out there. Do you see that more now than ever?
I think so. You know, like 10 years ago, if you had a bottle of Sonoma and a Russian River side-by-side, most people would recognize Russian River, and then Sonoma Coast would be maybe like, I don't understand it, but now I feel like they've almost evened
right.
out.
That was kind of my point. You know,
Russian River is probably still more popular and recognizable, but
I think that's gonna equal out a little.
Yeah.
You know? All right, so if people want more information on Copain Wines, what's the best place to go? The website?
Hit up the CopainWines.com website.
What
follow
about
us on Instagram.
Social media? Tell me about social media handles.
Our Instagram handle is just Copain Wines.
And do you have a Instagram? Like,
oh, yeah.
If people want to see you skateboarding,
yeah, I need more
naked,
followers.
Can they?
Well, we won't have that, but
okay.
Maybe some other embarrassing things.
Okay.
But yeah, just
where
my name, Ryan Zapaltas, at Ryan Zapaltas.
Zapaltas, right?
Yeah, I got to get my followers up to so I can be an influencer.
So tell me quickly, what are you doing at the festival? You doing some tastings or
all sorts of stuff? I just did an Anderson Valley seminar. I hosted for about 40 people. Very like we walked through from Boonville to Navarro, throughout the valley, tasted wines through all parts.
Are you done with events, or you have
one more? I have a I'm done with events.
Okay.
I
when
got
are you
one
leaving
private
town?
Dinner tonight? But 5 a.m. tomorrow morning.
Okay, good for you. All right, Ryan, we got to wrap up. I want to thank you for taking some time talking about Copain.
Thank you for having me.
Letting us know a little more about you. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network on tour. I'm Sam Ben Ruby from the Grape Nation. We want to thank the Julia Child Foundation for making our coverage possible. Stay tuned for more Charleston Wine and Food. Again, thank you, Ryan Zapaltas from Copain Wines. Good luck, and thank you for sitting with us.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate
Thanks.
It.
This program is powered by Simplecast.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.